Heavenly Father, we want to ask your help. You open up your word, speak to us, teach us, and help us to apply these things to every area of our lives. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. As we continue our way through Jesus' teaching from the Mount, he now turns the corner to address a new area. This section of his teaching gets really at the core of who we are. Gets right at the core. If you turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 6, starting at verse 19, we read these things. Jesus says to us, "Don't collect for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But collect for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroy, nor where thieves break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there is your heart also. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. So if the light within you is darkness, how deep is that darkness? No one can be a slave of two masters, since either he will hate one and love the other, or be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot be slaves of God and of money." And so what we learn will tell us, and what we see here will tell us what we're made up of and how we're to live in a world that we are in and yet not be sold out to it. We're in the world but not of it. And how do we live like that? We're going to find out. Who you are is shown in what you delight in. Where's your delight? What is your most delightful thing? What you treasure is where your priorities rest. Doesn't matter what you say, because our actions speak louder than our words. What you do. You see, the question is, where's your heart? Where's your heart? Because the heart is always the issue, isn't it? The heart's always the issue. Most people never take the time to ask themselves this question. Where's my heart? Well, communion, usually we do that, and we take some time and we find out where our heart is, but we need more often than just every 6 weeks to ask that question, where's my heart? This question needs to be addressed by each of us on a regular basis, not in some morbid introspection like some people do. They just get in there and they just beat themselves to death and you know, they wonder why. It's not a morbid introspection, it's where's my heart? What has my life been showing as to where my priorities are? When somebody looks at me, where would they say, if I were to ask them, what you see of me, where do you think my priorities are? And they, based on what they see, may give you an answer you don't want to hear. Or they may give you an answer that's right on target because you're right on target with where you're supposed to be. And so it's not a morbid introspection, but it's a way to say, am I on track? Am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing? Am I going the right way? See, our heart is always the issue. Out of it flows the abundance of life. Out of it flows the things of life. Solomon tells us what we need to do about that, and he gives us great instruction on what we're to do about that in Proverbs chapter 4 and verse 23, because we're to guard our hearts. We're to guard our hearts. We're to set a sentinel there. We're to set a guard there to protect our hearts. And that's what he says in Proverbs chapter 4, verse 23. Guard your heart above all else. No matter what else you do, guard your heart, for it is the source of life. And he's not talking about the heart that's beating within you, pumping that life-flowing blood. He's talking about your heart, because that's where your life is. Guard your heart. That's a pretty important thing for us to think about. And you see, as we think about that, guard it, protect it, watch it. This is a pretty important thing, and it is out of the heart that we will really see where our treasure is. We'll really see where our priorities are. We'll really see what that main thing is that motivates us and moves us forward. You see, the best way to tell where a person's priorities are is to look at what they spend the most time on and the most money on. That'll be a good indicator of where your priorities are. The old saying was to look at a checkbook and you can see where a person's priorities are. A lot of people don't use checkbooks anymore, so that's an old saying, but it gives you the idea. Where you spend your money, where you spend your time, pretty good indicator where your priorities are. So Jesus gives us the warning, alerting us to where our focus in life should be, where we need to be centering our attention, where we need to be centering everything that we do. It's not sin to have a savings account. It's not sin to have an emergency fund or to have proper investments. That's not what Jesus is saying. He's not saying live like a poverty-stricken individual. What Jesus is talking about is being aware of the dangers of wrong priorities and the things that you put your values in. And that's something that we need to be very cautious of in our lives. Where are you putting your values? What do you have your values in? What do you see as the most important? You see, in the original text, if you were to read this, sometimes it doesn't make as much sense as the English, but sometimes it comes across stronger. The original text says, do not lay up treasure for your treasures on the earth. Do not lay up treasure for your treasures on the earth. In other words, this has a little more force than the English language that just tells us don't collect for yourselves treasures, because it's talking about what are you treasuring? Don't lay up those treasures. You see, it's got that put input. Treasure not your treasures. Don't treasure those earthly things at all. Isn't it easy to get caught up in the things around you? Doesn't take much, does it, for us to get sidetracked sometimes. The things that soon become our wants, because now we think they're needs. And there's a cycle that's always there. If only I had just a little bit more of this, or I just need this one more thing. If I just get that one more thing, then everything's going to fall into place. And we begin to see, where's my treasure? Where's my target? Question, do spiritual things come up in your mind like that? Do spiritual things come to your thoughts like that? If only I had a little more faith. If only in my prayer life, I had a stronger prayer life. My prayer life was a little better, a little more organized. If only I had more time or took the time to memorize more. If only, you know, I would have and work on a way to spend more time with the Lord. Do those questions come up, or do the other side of the questions come up first? You see, usually it's the earthly things that dominate much of our thought life, unfortunately. That's why Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10, he says, take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. You literally have to take your thoughts and say, whoa, 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 where's it? No, 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 I'm not obeying you. You will do what I tell you, and I am going to take these thoughts captive to the obedience of Christ. He tells that in that section of spiritual warfare in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. And so we need to make sure that we do that in our lives. And so we need to spend that time. Usually these earthly things dominate. We need to turn that around. What comes to mind when you think of treasure or treasures? Excuse me. A chest full of gold, silver, jewels, a whole stack of $100 bills, Uncle Ben's there on the desk. What comes to mind? Well, the caution here is guarding the things that motivate you. Talk to a young person and ask them about their future. Heard this again just yesterday from some of my grandkids. I want to be a millionaire. Well, that's fine, but you're sure not living like you're going to be a millionaire. Because I've heard their dad say, millionaires don't always go out to eat. Millionaires don't spend their money like that. Millionaires don't do this and they don't do that. How do you think they got there? So we need to realize there's more to life than being a millionaire. If God calls you to be a millionaire, he'll provide you the way and the means. It doesn't have to dominate your life. You seek him first and he'll provide. You see, society puts great pressure on our lives to conform to its standards. Paul mentions that, and we'll look at that in just a minute in Romans chapter 12. There's a tremendous amount of pressure that's there. But if you have these things, or if you're a member of that club, then you've arrived. You've made it. You're there. Wear this brand of clothes. Drive these types of cars. Live in these zip codes. Man, you're there. You've arrived. You're living. You've got it made. Jesus, on the other hand, is saying to us, don't get caught up in the rat race of life, seeking to amass for yourselves things that will ultimately be worthless and amount to nothing. I don't read anywhere in the scriptures that when we leave this world, we're taking anything with us. I haven't found that yet. I mean, I've seen people buried in their Porsches and in their Mercedes and those kinds of things. Like, you think you're going to drive that somewhere? You think that's going anywhere? Paul warns us, Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, do not be conformed to this age, but be transformed. How? By the renewing of your mind, so that you may discern what is the good, pleasing, and perfect will of God. We're to be transformed. We're to be changed. There's a metamorphosis that takes place. In the same way that out of a cocoon, an ugly cocoon that you see laying around there, a beautiful butterfly can come crawling out. The metamorphosis. That's what needs to be happening in our minds. For where your treasure is, there's your heart. The most obvious truth and a most heavy reason why we should not make anything on earth our treasure is because whatever we make our treasure gains possession of our heart. Now it becomes who we are or what we're striving for. We set our affections on it. And the consequence of that, according to John in 1 John 2:15, the love of the Father is not in us. And we're not there where we think we are. If this is what you're doing, the love of the Father is not in you. I don't know about you, but I don't want to be doing anything that kicks out the love of the Father and becomes more of a priority. So don't lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. The original hearers of Jesus' day understood very well what he was saying here. Treasures or wealth among the ancients consisted in clothes, changes of clothes, as well as gold, silver, gems, jewelry, wine, land, oil, those kinds of things. It meant an abundance of anything. So when Jesus is talking to these people, they know what he's getting at. There's abundance of any of these things that was held to be conducive to an ornament or comfort of life. You see, as the Orientals delighted in the showy things of splendor. They wanted flashy clothes. They wanted very nice stuff more than anybody else, and parading around in that. That was what they did. And so in these splendid things, there would be costly garments. Their treasures, in fact, consisted much, a lot, in the beautiful, richly ornamented articles of clothing. You think about Genesis, when Joseph gave his brothers changes of clothes. There was things that he had because of who he was. So that it was, you know, he was second in command to Pharaoh. Therefore, he had all these garments at his disposal. Joshua, remember, where Achan, what did he do? He coveted some idols and a garment from Babylon because that was the cool thing. This fact will account for the use then where Jesus says to us, where moth, you know, we're not too concerned about moths today, are we? We don't like them flying around our house. But they were very concerned about the moth. When we speak of wealth, we think of gold, silver, land, houses, you know, vehicles, tractors, whatever. But when a Hebrew or an Oriental spoke of these things, they were talking and thinking about their clothes, those things that would make a display. And they included those essential things, those articles that were very splendid in dress. The moth then, as small of an insect as it was an enemy. That enemy would come in and would destroy the clothes, would destroy those things that you put so much emphasis on, so much treasure in. Man, look at this closet full of stuff. Now all of a sudden you open it up and there's a whole flock of moths, or however moths fly, and there's a whole bunch of moths in there and they're eating on your garments. You see, the moth would destroy their apparel. The rust would destroy and work on their silver and gold, so that all their treasures would waste away. So the word used for rust actually signifies, because gold's not going to rust, it might tarnish, it signifies anything that eats into. And so when he uses that word rust, anything that eats into, and these then would be things that would consume your property, would consume your wealth and whatever else you had, and it would consume those. It would eat into that. It would eat its way in. People say today that the economy's eating into their savings. No, then Jesus would say that's rust. It's eating into it because the inflation gets so high and it's eating those things. But Jesus adds more. He says, where thieves break in and steal. Remember, they didn't live in houses like we do. They lived in houses that were frequently made of hardened clay, hardened in the sun, loose stones. Remember the miracle where they let the guy down on the mat because they couldn't get him into Jesus? What did they do? They dug through that clay roof, were able to make a hole there, and down he came. I don't know what happened to all the fragments that were falling down. I always wondered about that. There got to be stuff falling down out of that hitting people. And maybe that's how they got room to put him down in front of Jesus, because they backed out of the way as much as they could because of the stuff falling. But they were made of that way. So it was comparatively easy for a thief to say, I know, I saw what they got in the marketplace today. I saw what they bartered for. I saw those things. And tonight, I'm going through that side wall and I'm going to get them. They had nothing. They might have a stick or something to beat you off, but they didn't have any way to protect themselves. And so then in verse 20, Jesus tells us as he shifts gears, but collect for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves don't break in and steal. So on the other side, the other hand, he's saying, Jesus now gives us the alternative of what we should be doing. How do we build treasure in heaven then? Because that's what he's telling us to do. We need to do that. These things are heaven. We need to be looking at that. Collect for yourselves treasures in heaven. I can't forward anything. I can't wire something from my bank. Well, I want this to go to heaven. And they're going to look at you in the bank and they're going to say, call security, you know, or get somebody on the phone over here because we got some kind of nut in here who's trying to wire money to heaven. That's not what Jesus is talking about. How do we build it? Well, actually, if we go back all the way to the third verse of chapter 6, from there on, Jesus is giving us ways to build treasures in heaven. The proper attitude in our giving to the poor, our attitude, our prayer with the proper attitude. Are you praying with the proper attitude? What about forgiving? Are you doing the forgiving that he's talked about here in the sixth chapter? Are you forgiving others? Are you doing that? Are you seeking forgiveness? Are you giving forgiveness? And then, remember last week we talked about the disciplines, especially the discipline of fasting. Those are some ideas. And then there's, how else? Well, any other areas of service that you give to the Lord and help others with. Any ministry done for the Lord with a proper attitude. And there's the key. Because I've said, you know, in 47 years of ministry, I've seen good attitudes and I've seen bad attitudes where people, all right, I'll do that. And I'm thinking to myself, dude, you just lost your reward in heaven. Watch your attitude with what you're given things to do. And on the other hand, there's other people who delight in the fact that they want to help and they want to be a part. And so they're building treasure in heaven with that attitude. Living in obedience to the word helps build treasures in heaven. Sharing our faith, teaching, volunteer work for the Lord at church, all build treasures if our attitude is in the right place, if our attitude is where it's supposed to be. If you go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul kind of deals with this a little bit, starting in verse 11. He says, for no one can lay any other foundation than what has been laid down. That foundation is Jesus Christ. If anyone builds on that foundation, and here's where you build treasures in heaven, with gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, each one's work will become obvious, for the day and that day is the judgment when we are judged by our works, the Bema Seat judgment in heaven for Christians, will disclose it because it will be revealed by fire. The fire will test the quality of each one's works. If anyone's work that he has built survives, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, it'll be lost, but he will be saved, yet it will be like an escape through fire. And so, building treasures in heaven. If we were to try to list everything to build heavenly treasure, it would be futile. I mean, we could sit here all day looking at naming things that would work. So the best thing that we can do is to be obedient to the Lord, His Word, and abide in Him, giving our total self to Him in His service. John 15 says, "Remain, I'm the vine, you're the branch. Remain in me. Be obedient. Obey my word." Those are those things that are building treasures in heaven. Our treasures in heaven are protected, unlike those here on earth. So the conclusion of the matter is summed up in verse 21, where he says, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." That's not a conditional thing. That's exactly, when Jesus says that's what's going to happen, that's what's going to happen. You see, for if the treasure which you have gathered is on earth, so will your heart be there with its feelings and its dispositions and tendencies will be there on earth. And those areas of your inner life are going to be down here, focused here, will be ethically bound to the earth and vice versa. For the treasure which is the result of effort and the object of love, the heart cannot be separated from it. In the ground of our duty, in the core of our duty, it's assumed that the believer's heart must be in heaven. It must be there. That's what's assumed. It doesn't always happen that way, but that's what should happen. If you look at Colossians chapter 3 and in verse 2, Paul makes that clear to us. He says, "Set your minds on what is above and not what is on earth." And then he goes in and explains why. We don't have that time to look at that. You can check it out later. But where he says, "Set your minds." This is where your affection should be. Where your mind is, your heart's going to be. It's going to follow suit. Set your minds on those things that are above. Seek Him first. First in the morning, "Lord, here's my day. Here's my calendar. Here's all these things. Is this in line with You? I want to seek You first." And when those distractions come or those interruptions come, instead of looking at them and getting frustrated by them and getting all ticked off by them, realize maybe the Lord allowed those things to come in for a reason. Don't scoff at the interruptions. Don't scoff at the things that all of a sudden changed your agenda today. Maybe they protected you. Maybe they helped you in some way that you will find out maybe that day or maybe down the road. But then you'll say, "Oh, yeah." But you see, again, attitude. What's my attitude? I don't know about you. I don't like those kinds of things. And it's easy to get upset about those things. It's easy to be, you know, get us on edge. But we need to back off. And we say, "Hey, if I gave my day to Him and these things are happening." Now, if I do something goofy and something dumb, then I can only expect what I've done. But if I'm doing everything according to His will and these things happen, then I can be assured there's a reason. And I need to learn that. Saw that with one of my grandkids yesterday. They wanted something really bad. They needed something really bad. He asked me if I'd go with him to town and look at it. He wanted this air compressor. They had everything we needed. We looked at all the parts. It wasn't in stock after all of that. And normally I said, "So what are you going to do? You want to buy something now?" "Yeah." And then all of a sudden he got to think, "I'll wait." And I told him later, I says, "Good choice. Don't do something now that you're going to regret later." He says, "You learned to back off, and you put that off until a better time." And that's what we need to learn here. When we set our minds on those things, we're realizing that we are allowing Him to do His work in our lives. That's the way we build that treasure. And so when He says where your treasure is, that's where your heart is, that's where it follows. Paul's goal in life should be our goal in life. If you look at Philippians chapter 3, verses 13 and 14, Paul mentions this fact, and he says, "Brothers, I do not consider myself to have taken hold of it. But one thing I do, forgetting what is behind, in other words, I'm not hauling yesterday's garbage, I'm not hauling all that stuff from my past, I'm not hauling all that junk with me, and forgetting what's behind, he says, and reaching forward to what's ahead. Learn from your past, yes, but don't drag it along. He says, I pursue as my goal the prize promised by God's heavenly call in Christ Jesus. That's where our goal should be. I want my goal to be that heavenly call, that prize. So collect for yourselves treasures in heaven. That is, have you made provision? Making provision for your eternal home. Don't exhaust yourself. Don't worry yourself out. Don't spend all your strength and your time providing only for this life. Let your chief goal be preparing for eternity, be at the forefront of what you do. In heaven, nothing corrupts. Nothing terminates. No enemies steal. Nobody destroys. To have treasure in heaven is to possess evidence that there is purity and joy that'll be ours. So, it is to be heirs of God. That's important. Join heirs with Christ. To be an inheritance, incorruptible, undefiled, that doesn't fade away. And that's what Peter teaches us in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 4, where he makes that statement. And into an inheritance that is imperishable, uncorrupted, and unfading, kept in heaven for you. That's the inheritance that we're building and that we want to be building into. The heart or our affections will, of course, be fixed on the treasure. To regulate the heart, it is therefore important that the treasure or the object needs to be right and should be the right one. Then back in Matthew 6, verse 22, Jesus goes on and he says, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. So Jesus takes the theme here deeper, talking about the lamp of our body, talking about that lamp. Just like an eye that is healthy, it lets in the light. It lets us see so that we don't go down the wrong path, so that we don't run into things, so that we don't fall off a cliff or whatever. It's our inner being, our heart. Our heart needs light. A good eye will let the light in so that our whole body is sound, usable for God's glory and for what he wants to do in and through us. The light of the body, the message stated is in the preceding verse. The duty is fixing our attention, fixing our affections on heavenly things. And Jesus proceeds to illustrate that using the eye as an illustration. When the eye is directed steadily towards an object and is healthy, or sometimes the term is referred to as a single eye, everything is clear and everything is plain. If the eye is constantly moving around, flies off to different objects and always looking here and looking there, is fixed on no one thing singly, or maybe the eye is diseased, nothing seen clearly. Everything is dim. Everything's focused, like a person is getting a cataract on their eye. Colors aren't right. Things are dimmer. They need a brighter light. The person, therefore, is unsteady. So the eye regulates then the motion of the body. The eye sees clear. The body knows I can go straight forward. If it's not clear, it's like I'm not sure what to do. To have an object distinctly in view then is necessary in order for us to be correct in all of our actions that we do. Think of a tightrope walker. Maybe you've seen them. You know, they steady themselves. How? They fix their eye on something, an object on the wall way behind. They look steadily at that and that alone. They don't look down at the rope. They don't look at the people, because when they do, they get dizzy and down they come. But when they focus on something out straight, remember Peter walking on the water. When he was looking at Jesus, what happened? He's walking on water. You can't walk on water, but he did because he was focusing on Jesus. What happened when he had his eyes start to wander? Down he went. A man, if you cross, maybe you've done it before, you're crossing quite a long log over a stream. And if you look across at an object and keep your eye focused on that, you're probably going to make it across without slipping off into the water. Waitress carrying a whole tray full of stuff, glasses of water. She's not looking down at her feet to see what's going to happen, because if she does, there's going to be an accident. She's looking straight ahead. And even yourself, carrying a single glass of water, do yourself an experiment. Go and carry that across the room and watch that. And you're going to start shaking that thing, and you're going to spill. But look straight ahead, and you're going to see that you're going to make it across. So Jesus says, in order that your conduct, your life, the way you live, will be right, it's important, fix your attention, fix your affections, fix your love, fix your vision, like Paul said in Colossians 3:2, on heaven. Having your affections there, having the eye of faith single, steady, unwavering, all the conduct that you have in your life is going to be in line with what Jesus wants for us. To be single-minded, steady, directed to one object, not confused, as when a person's eyes are when they're seeing double or cross-eyed and looking at many things. We need to focus on what we're supposed to do, what we're supposed to be. James talks about a double-minded man being like waves that toss things around. He says that's not going to get anything accomplished. Your body, Jesus says, should be full of light. Your conduct will be regular then. Your conduct will be steady. All that's needed to direct the body is that the eye be focused in the right place on Him, on His goals, on heaven. You see, when we do that, then we begin to direct our lives the way they should be. When we have our eyes fixed on Him, when we have our eyes fixed on heaven, we have our eyes fixed on the goal, then we realize how important it is. I've been thinking more and more with the way we see our society going, to just drilling it into, driving it home into the heads of kids and grandkids and everything. You don't have time to play around, because time is short. And the thing that motivates that is eternity. Where are you going to spend it? Eternity is not a temporary thing. Eternity is not, well, you're going to be there for a little bit and then you're getting out. You're never getting out. It's eternity. Where are you going to spend eternity? Make sure your life is you're making the right choices. Have that single eye. Have your eye full of light so that you're going in the right direction. If the light that's in you, the word light here signifies that which is in your mind and in your heart and the principles of your soul. Jesus said, if that light is dark, how great is that darkness? In other words, it's going to mess you up. It's going to take you down the wrong path. So the light that is in us needs to be there. Verse 23, Jesus goes on. He says, but if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. So if the light within you is darkness, how deep is it? And that's the truth. If you're focusing on those things, if your eye is bad or evil, how deep is that darkness? It fills the person with all that's contrary to what Christ wants in our lives. As a result, our life will not be building treasure in heaven. We'll be earthly minded. The things of the Lord will not be a priority. We will be in danger of losing what we've worked for. Great care needs to be taken in our lives in order to be single minded and a disciple of Jesus. Sold out only to Him and His ways, like He expects us. So, the choice must be made in our lives. It's either the world's way or it's Jesus' way, His way. In verse 24, Jesus says, you can't be the slave of two masters, since either He will hate one and love the other, or be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot be slaves of God and of money. Jesus is saying, I don't care how hard you think you can try, or how smart you think you are in this area, you can't do it. You're not able. The choice is simple. We are the ones that make it hard. We're the ones that make it difficult. No man can serve. The word means, sir, to be holy and entirely under the command of. That's what happens when you become a servant or a slave. You're wholly and entirely under the command of the one that you're serving. No man can serve two masters. How can you be wholly and entirely under the command of two things at once? You can't. Christ proceeds to illustrate the necessity of laying up treasures in heaven from the well-known fact that a servant can't serve two masters at the same time. His affections and obedience is going to be divided. What if one says do this and the other one says do the opposite? What are you going to do? It can't be done. And he would fail altogether in his duty then to one or the other. One he would love, the other he would hate. So to the interests of the one, he'd follow those things. The interests of the other, he'd have to neglect them. And the law, that's just the law of human nature. The supreme affection, then, can be fixed only on one object. You can only be focused on one. So Jesus says, the servant of God cannot at the same time obey him and be striving or seeking treasure supremely on earth. He said it can't happen. One interferes with the other. And one or the other is going to have to be surrendered and gotten rid of. So as followers of Jesus, our total allegiance must be 100% sold out to him. There's no other way. No matter how hard a person might try, no matter what a person thinks, you can't serve Jesus and the world at the same time. Oil and water, no mix. Neither does a dual relationship. Can you imagine somebody getting married and developing a relationship with their wife and putting all that into it while still trying to maintain a relationship with a childhood sweetheart? It doesn't work. Not only is that sin, but it doesn't work. And it's not going to work. You have to be devoted single-mindedly to that one. So try, but it's not going to work. Once again, we see the statement made by Joshua, choose you today who you're going to serve. The choice seems to be obvious, yet many still struggle. Don't let it be you who struggles. That's not the way God intended it. He wants us to be sold out and single-minded toward him. Let's stand together as